So what I would like to do this afternoon to give you a view of Rick phenomenology as seen by the Phobos detector. And I have to start by saying that, you know, the four detectors in many ways overlap with each other. And the good news is that wherever they overlap, the result seem to be consistent and therefore presumably right. The bad aspect is that as we go in time, there's going to be more and more repetition, and some of the things I'm going to tell you has already been presented in other talks, in particular Fleming's. Now, Phobos is one of the smaller experiments. It consists of, there's 8 institutions and about 50 physicists. And since this is, a talk aimed at the theorists, I'll limit myself to 2 transparencies to do with the equipment. So the way to visualize what Phobos is basically to imagine the following. Here is the beam pipe. There are the beams come down here, collide at this point, and essentially we cover the full 4 pi around the interaction region with a single layer of detectors, silicon detectors, with which we can measure the production angle both in azimuth and the polar angle of all the charged particles. If I unfold the detectors, you can plot here the angle, basically, the polar angle, and the units here are the pseudo-rapidity, which you're all familiar with, minus logarithm of the tangent of the angle. And here is the azimuth. Every dot on here shows a particle, a charged particle, going at some phi and theta. And we can, event by event, essentially measure all the charged particles in that way. That's a real event, yes. That's a real event. And each hit here is a signal from the silicon detector. The color coding is the amplitude of the information, because as the particles go through different angles of the silicon, they deposit less or more energy. So that's one bit of information we have, and we have that event by event. In addition, covering about 2% of the solid angle, we have 2 spectrometers with which we can both measure the momentum of the particles and identify them. And the phase space coverage is shown here. We have about 0.2 in radians in azimuth. And here you can see that basically our spectrometers cover near central rapidity. And we identify particles through DEDX up to these regions and with time of flight up to there. So that's our coverage. In particular, we have low momentum cutoff down to close to 50 MeV over C for pions. And this is the second slide. This is an engineering drawing of the detector as it's on the floor. What you do not see here is the upper half of the magnet. Otherwise, it's basically the whole detector. Here is the beam pipe. And it's the only experiment which is designed to go to very forward rapidities. And so we have a 12-meter beryllium pipe. It's the longest beryllium pipe on site. There is this beryllium pipe. The interaction region is here. The experiment is surrounded, as I mentioned before, by silicon detectors. Here are 2 arms of the spectrometers. This is a pole of one pole of the magnet. The other one is back here. These are the time of flight counters. And here are big scintillation arrays with which we measure the centrality. Now, despite the fact that the number of participants has been used in the community for a long time, there is still a reasonable amount of confusion what that is. And so I will spend a few minutes try to explain what it is. first of all, it's easiest to see what happens in a Pa collision. Here you have a proton which has gone through the nucleus. The number of participants is any nucleon which has interacted. So in this case, on this picture, it's 6 of those nucleons. Now, the assumption made, well, I'll come to that in a second. Here is an AA collision, and again, these red dots are the participants. They are those nucleons which have at least once interacted with anything. That's the meaning of it. Now, clearly, we don't have a Maxwell demon sitting there looking and seeing which nucleon has been hit. So what are the assumptions you have to make to get this number? The assumptions you have to make is the following. Basically, there are two. First of all, whenever you have a collision and you produce many particles, you make the assumption that the number of particles produced is monotonic with the number of participants. It doesn't matter what function it is, but it's monotonic. That there will be always more particles produced if there are more participants. That's one assumption. The other assumption, which is on much weaker ground, is the following. Let's take this case. When the proton goes through the nucleus, you make the assumption that the cross-section of the proton does not change as it goes from one collision to the next. All right? Now, that's not obvious. It's reasonable because if you look at the time, after all, this proton or this nucleus going through, is the time's dilated, the clock on that object is very slow, and for the object to change transversely in size, it doesn't have much time. And two, in the 70s, etc., a lot of studies went on this in studying hadron nucleus scattering, in which, for example, it was demonstrated that if you assume that a proton changes into a kaon or a pion, that it's still the number of collisions it makes is like a proton cross-section rather than a kaon or a pion one. All right? And so in order to get this, what one does is literally you then use the other assumption that goes in, that you know the nucleus structure. And you use the Glauber model then. Nuclear parameters are reasonably known. You use the Glauber model, and then you can calculate how many hit just from the, basically, as mentioned earlier today, knowing the fraction, taking the fraction of the, here is a distribution of number of particles created in some detector, and you can then divide it into the most central, etc., and then through this Glauber model calculation, you can get a relationship between the number of participants and this. But let me give you an example of something which is not obvious. For the same impact parameter, the number of participants changes with energy. Because it is assumed that the PP cross-section is the real PP cross-section. So, for example, when you compare data between SPS, 130 GV at RIC, or 200 GV, for the same impact parameter, you have different number of participants. Okay, so some of our results. Here is a compilation of our result on the overall pseudorapidity distributions at both the 130 GV and now the highest energy at RIC. The error bars are indicated. These include all systematic errors, etc. So that's the thing. And precisely because I couldn't put here number of participants, because I'd have to have a different one on the two sides, I'm here showing it as a fraction of centrality. And what one sees is that basically as a first approximation, it all looks the same, independent of what the overlap is, how many participants interacted, what the energy is, they look very, very similar. It's interesting to see that the largest number that are direct at the highest energies you produce of the order of 5,000 charged particles in totality. Now, just, I thought it would be interesting to compare what did we see in the good old days in PP scattering, and again, as a first approximation, what I've, this is ISR PP data, here is various energies, here is overall multiplicity, which to me is a measure of centrality of the collision, and other than the most peripheral ones, you've seen that the character is very, very similar, whether it's PP or gold on gold. Now, in order to get a better feel what this data means, one has to look more closely at different aspects of it. And the first thing I want to do is just to remind you of something. If one looks in the target fragmentation region, in other words, if one looks at collisions where one of the incident states is stationary, say a fixed target experiment, and if you look at, for example, the pseudo-rapidity distribution, in this case, the rapidity distributions in PP, what you see is that those particles which are essentially produced at close to being at rest with respect to that stationary target, that the produced particles there are independent of the energy of the incident state. And what was observed is that as the energy of the incident protons went up, the region grew, which was independent of the incident energy, and this was given the name, the production approached a limiting value, hence the word limiting fragmentation. The same was observed, for example, in PA scattering. Here is PA scattering, where A in this particular case was an emulsion, and you can see from 67 to 400 GeV that the fragments of the emulsion are not dependent on the energy. Or if you plot it in the rest frame of the proton, AP scattering again shows the limiting fragmentation. When the SPS came in, the same was observed at higher and higher energies. Here is data from UA5, and what you see is now we are plotting everything in the rest frame of one of these protons, and you can see this limiting fragmentation. And the interesting fact, which I'm not sure what the explanation is, notice this fragmentation region grows with energy. It's not the central rapidity region that grows rapidly, it's the fragmentation region. The higher the energy, over a larger range in rapidity, the fragments are the same, independent of the energy. At RIC, the same phenomenon on the scene. So here, what we are plotting now, the pseudo-rapidity distributions, or which I'm approximating by rapidity here, in the rest frame of one of the nuclei. And here is SPS data, RIC 130, RIC 200. And notice this fact that as you go to higher energies, this fragmentation region, if you can call it, covers a bigger and bigger fraction of the rapidity range. The biggest effect of changing the energy seems to be an expansion of this region. It is not the expansion of the boost invariant flat rapidity, the plateau, which is almost independent of energy. There is a fountain of X, but for another reason I'm showing it. That's what you're asking for, a fountain of X, right? Let me tell you so. Right, let me continue for a second. The next thing is, if one looks now what happens in this fragmentation region as a function of centrality, in other words, where the target is hit by thicker and thicker objects. Again, to remind you, if you compare pi p with pp, you don't see much difference. But the difference between a pion and proton is not so great. What happens if you have much more bigger objects hitting the target? Here again, I can remind you back to the days when people were studying what happens if you hit a proton with a nucleus. All right? Then what one found was that if you hit a proton with a nucleus, then in fact you would slightly, in the fragmentation, you would slightly reduce the number of particles produced. Here is some Fermilab data where you can see that if you have compare in the very forward direction, PP scattering with lead P, you get per participant far fewer particles. And in fact, at RIC, the same phenomenon is seen. If you compare gold-gold collisions at the same energy, but compare central events with peripheral events, you see this crossover at the where the more peripheral events have a higher multiplicity in the very forward or backward direction. And as I say, this is nothing other, as far as I am concerned, than what was seen a long time ago in the proton nucleus, where you see the same. Here is, for example, PA data, where if you look in the forward direction, you see this crossover as you go to higher and higher A's, this cuts off earlier. Now, being an experimenter, I don't feel I have to be very precise in any interpretations of the data, but I like to also be able to visualize what's going on. And so let me share with you if I look at all the data to do with PP, PA, and AA in the fragmentation regions, what I see in them. I find that the data is roughly consistent with the following picture. You have a Lorentz contracted incoming nucleus with a clock which is going very, very slowly in it, all right, coming, colliding with the stationary nucleons in the target. As this goes through, this nucleus basically behaves like a solid wall of gluons, which as they go through this, basically sweep out the gluons from the stationary protons. And you are left behind something like the valence quarks here. The number left behind, it does slightly depend on this object. In fact, in some data we did a long time ago, we even tried to measure the cross-section. It comes out about 10 millibarns, crudely speaking, this object. So depending on the thickness, some of these do get slightly wiped out of the way, but most actually stay behind. And once this nucleus has gone through, those fragments, quarks fragment into the particles which we see. That's why it's base energy independent, because that's only to do with the you wipe out all these gluons in any case. These then fragment into those particles, but also there a little bit of multiple scattering occurs, which increases the particles in that region. Now, that picture works for, as far as I'm concerned, works for all the data I've seen, except for one. And this is an observation that Peter Steinberg made, which I find intriguing, and there are two possibilities, interesting or it's an accident. And it's the following. If you take the gold-gold, the 200 GeV data, these are the open circles, and if you plot on top of that the UEFI PP data, same energy, 200 GeV, you get incredible agreement if you scale the UEFI data by a factor of 1.33. Now, and notice it seems to work over almost the entire rapidity range. And I find this very hard to understand for the following reason. I certainly know that the particles produced here are produced in the medium of the nucleus. And we know from, again, from PA scatterings, that there is multiple collisions. And if you look at PA data, in the higher values of rapidity here, you get more multiplication than back here. And so I do not understand how this miraculously could agree here. So either this is something literally many factors just canceling, some increase because of multiple scattering, some decrease because some of the fragments are wiped out on the way in, or it's telling us something that I have no idea what it means. And I think Peter in his talk wants to say something about this, but I'm pointing that out because I find this agreement remarkable. So that's the fragmentation region. Let's move over to the central region. Now we have to look at the collision in the rest frame of the center of mass system, where both the nuclei are coming in, Lorentz contracted like this. And what you see is the data. Here is SPS, 130, 200 GeV per participant. The level of the plateau grows. There is some evidence of a boost invariant plateau. As I've mentioned before, it's not growing very much. The biggest effect still is what I mentioned earlier, is the growth of the fragmentation regions. But there is some increase with energy. If you, instead of looking at the energy, if you look at the how the level of the plateau changes with the thickness of the nuclei colliding, there too you see some increase. For me, the most surprising observation in the beginning of the RIC program is if you look at the level of the plateau per participant as a function of energy, it's remarkably uninteresting. It's straight. And it's much lower than most people predicted. I'm not going to show the transparency that had been shown many times. There was that famous transparency at quark matter where all the theories, predictions were shown, and this and our data was on the far low end. And at 200 GeV, it's still at the far low end. So what? And now if we remember, for example, what Frank mentioned earlier today, somewhere in here, presumably, the number of degrees of freedom have changed from, my memory is up to what was it, 50, from up to 52, from what is it now, from 3, right? Okay, I can't talk and think at the same time, so. So it went from 3 to 52, and yet look how straight this is. I mean, it's mind-boggling, all right? Now, in the spirit of doing everything qualitatively, no theory if at all possible, I've also decided I'm going to try to estimate from our data what's the lowest energy density that must exist at some instant of time. And I think that the simplest way to do it is simply to say, look, let's just ask how many particles are scattered out of the beam, in some sense, or how much energy is scattered out of the beam. And so I'm going to take all the particles that come out into a cone of 45 degrees. Therefore, it means that more component transversely than longitudinally. All right? So surely that is in part of the just sheer momentum of the incoming state, all right? And that actually I can measure better than if I measured rapidity directionally, because pseudo-rapidity measures that angle, okay? And if I include both the charge and neutral, there's of the order of 1,000 particles produced. The average energy of these particles is of the order of a GeV. All right, so the total energy released in these collisions is of the order of 2,000 GeV. And now, at least at some instant of time, I'm not saying it's thermalized, but at some instant of time, all those, that energy must have come from a region which is at most about a Fermi. And why do I use a Fermi? Not because it's in the BJ formula, but simply because that's the wavelength of the particles we're talking about. All right? So it's very fundamental. It may be much smaller, I won't argue with that, but it cannot be bigger. All right? And so if I use all that, I get, and some people who know me have known that I fought against this number in the past, it is of at least of the order of 10 GeV per cubic Fermi at some instant earlier in the collision. And I think that's clearly a very interesting number. The next, how about the density, the change in the energy density or the number of particles produced as a function of centrality? And here, let me just point out why it's a non-trivial question and why it is interesting. See, we know that we were looking at the particles produced in the central rapidity, then the two nuclei hit each other with all the components essentially simultaneously. I mean, essentially all the protons are within at 1/10 of a Fermi. If you remember that the Lorentz contraction here is a gamma is of 100, right? So if I take this nucleus Lorentz contracted, you're talking about 1/10 of a Fermi. These components are in there, and they hit each other. So all the protons from both nuclei hit each other simultaneously for all practical purposes. And it's an interesting question. Suppose one-on-one, I've now expanded this. These all hit each other simultaneously, but so I can talk about it, I've expanded it longitudinally here. If in the number of particles produced in a one-on-one is one, the question is, in this situation where they all hit each other simultaneously, would you expect 4 or would you expect 16? All right? And you don't need much imagination to realize that is an interesting question. That what actually goes on tells us something about the dynamics. Which, if I divide by the number of participants, it means, is this 1 or 4? Okay? Now, what happens in reality, I should have really drawn 6 here and said, on the average, each one of these hits 6 in the collisions that I get from Glauber model, all right? So so the question is it the same as in PP, or it can go as much as, on this scale, up to 12? Okay, and what one finds is nature, as usual, does something in between. It gently goes up just to confuse us, not to tell us immediately what's going on. All right, but I think there's a lot of information there about the initial process, and one can certainly parameterize it, but I'm not sure it tells you anything more as a fraction of a bit of this and a bit of that, call it soft plus hard, okay? You certainly can fit the data with a parameterization, but I'm not sure it gives us any insight into it. One gets a little more insight by these calculations, for example, to do with saturation, where basically the assumption is that although these things hit each other at the same time, there are not as many as you think because of saturation effects. Basically, you're trying to pile on top of each other too many protons or gluons. There's not enough room for them. They interact, boost themselves with higher p-perps, and get out of the way. So, the saturation model fits that. The data nicely. And just as an illustration, for example, here is that a overall, I don't want to use the word, the calculation of the Karjayev and Levin, is it right? On the saturation model, which they up to a reasonable range, I cut off because it goes crazy, the formula after that. But if I cut it off there, you find that you can get reasonably good agreement with the data with a sort of a saturation picture. Okay, so much for the multiparticle production. The next thing is not so new, so many of you would have seen it, but basically we have also used that detector of ours, with which we can measure the azimuthal angle of every particle, to look at the azimuthal distribution of particles. And as you all know, you see this phenomenon of elliptic flow. You see that when the overlapping nuclei are not central, and so there is this oval shape overlap region, there is clear evidence of a high pressure situation which drives more particles here and here than in that direction. Okay, this is just to show agreement with the star experiment on this. What you see is that the elliptic flow clearly is zero when you have complete overlap. There's no asymmetry in the azimuthal direction. It has to be zero, they miss each other. But as you are in between, you get more and more, the more of an asymmetric situation you get, like this. From our data, the thing which I would like to point out, which surprises me, is if you measure the flow as a function of pseudorapidity, it appears to be pointed. What's happened to boost invariance that one sees for dn d-eta? After all, dn d-eta seem to be a boost invariant for about plus or minus 2 units. And here, now it is possible that it's statistical fluctuations, but certainly the data suggests that you do have a non-boost invariance there, and that there is the pressure is changes rapidly as you move slightly from the thing.
Well, I mean, Peter Kotick saying that when you have flat rapidity distribution, you have slight dip in the pseudorapidity distribution, as you see it for the MDT data, and you have a slight peak in the pseudorapidity distribution of V2 for the single
distribution. No, but hold on. V2, this is as a function of it, it's just an angle. You mean that the pseudo, not the, you have no objections with this. What you're saying is that the dn d eta is not boost invariant. That's what you're telling me.
I'm saying dn dy is boost invariant, then dn d eta
is not. But the data shows you that the n d eta is flat, which means that the n dy is not flat. So that's a possible explanation, that the n dy is not boost invariant. I'm sorry, if you look at the data, it is remarkably flat. I mean, this is the data, friends. If you see any dips there, I mean, it's okay, fine. I have no problem. No problem. I'm pointing it out, it's interesting. I don't have an explanation. All right? Finally, we have measured particle ratios at both 130 GeV and 200 GeV. And what one finds, not too surprisingly, the further you, the incident states, the further they are from central rapidity, the fewer of the baryons end up in the middle, and they're approaching basically a vacuum, a baryon-free region. Okay? And my only comment there would be, again, going back to some old data, that the numbers of baryons left in the central rapidity is essentially what one would have expected 15 years or 20 years ago, based on stopping of protons in nuclear targets. It's consistent with what one sees. So I don't see anything of particular significance at the moment. If one uses the ratios of protons to antiprotons, and tries to calculate baryochemical potential from those ratios, it's interesting that it's possible to fit the data. This is Redlich et al. Did this, and their parameterization of a fit to this agreed rather nicely with what we measured recently. So look, I will actually bring the talk to a conclusion. I would, if I look at all the data that we have looked at, my general conclusion is the following. I am surprised that the ND data is so smooth with the logarithm of energy. I don't really understand that. It's disappointing that the energy densities turned out to be lower than we all hoped for. Clearly, the higher the energy density, the better would it have been. Nevertheless, the numbers are high enough to make this energy regime very interesting. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that this we must be way over in an interesting energy regime. Clearly, the elliptic flow suggests a high pressure. And to my naive thinking, I am a little surprised that the ND eta is apparently almost Boost invariant, and this is sharper. There may be good explanations, but I'm surprised by that. I think in the fragmentation regions there are no big surprises. But I think there is a lot of information there, not about what happens. Multiple interactions after the initial interaction, but I think there's a lot of information in the fragmentation regions about the initial interaction, what actually goes on, and I would love a good explanation, for example, why the fragmentation regions seem to increase with energy like this, while I mean, Feynman would be really surprised. He thought those regions would be constant beautifully, and the central plateau would grow. And what we're finding is the central plateau is hardly growing, and the fragmentation regions are growing. So that I don't understand, and I'm sure there is some important information there. I am mystified why you can take the PP data, multiply it by 1.3, and almost over the entire rapidity range get good agreement. To me, that's a mystery that I would have never predicted, and I'm surprised. I pointed out to you that its saturation seems to work quite well. Particle ratios, again, for me, there are no surprises there. It is what naively one would have expected to happen, and that's roughly what is happening. I've actually got an answer here to a question earlier on. Somebody asked, how can we have a better grip on this question of number of participants, etc.? And there is actually a way, and I would urge my experimental colleagues to help us persuade the operation of RIC to take some data with different nuclei. Because the one way you have of checking whether these calculations of the number of participants is correct is you make the same measurement with different nuclei colliding, in which you, if it's just a function of n participants, you should get the same result based on a different calculation of how many you're getting. And so it would be in the interest of the whole community if we had a species scan, and in my opinion, I would also like an energy scan to really convince us that that non-interesting rise with energy really is non-interesting. It is conceivable that there are wiggles there, which are small, so you need high precision, And we may be missing something. So I would urge to do that. But that probably is enough.
Okay. Thank you.
Start with Thomas Ulrich.
Yeah. I think I can answer for you.
right?
Okay.
Good comment.
Yes, but I just to be provocative, also to state a point that this fact that the multiplicity seems to be growing smoothly, mm-hmm. doesn't grow that much, is terribly interesting if you compare it to other observables. Because what we try to measure is the derivative, we change density and see what happens. So if you see that this density only increases by 40-50%, and then other observables like radial flow increases, elliptic flow increases factor 2, jet coefficient from small effect becomes order of magnitude effect, these derivatives are very impressive. So something is changing to that matter, although at the final state it looks nearly the same. Right.
Yeah, it's good to turn a bad thing positive.
So it's
right?
happening inside.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
Well, I found you interesting of the limiting fragmentation. I found your discussion of the limiting fragmentation interesting, but I was puzzled about one thing. How do you, when you compare SPS and Rick data and various images, how do you transform your whose angle distribution measured as we look at in your center of mass to whose angle distribution relative to the target, to the projectile frame?
Okay, I mean, this is not exact. What we basically were making the assumption that pseudo-rapidity and rapidity are the same. And so we boost and we do the Lorentz transformation on that. Now, let me tell you, it's not as bad as it may sound. Earlier bubble chamber experiments, people measured complete distributions in both eta and y. And there are differences. For example, at the center, there will be a difference of 10-15% introduced by that kind of thing. But the fragmentation regions are pretty well reproduced by that kind of a boost.
But it goes to average layer
theta. It's, yes.
At any high angle, the layer theta is 3.1.
Yeah.
It's worse at 90 degrees, it's always
better. Mm. Well, but when you transform into the rest frame, now you make it.
Yeah.
If the composition of heavy versus light changes near the fragmentation region,
yes, you're absolutely right. Pro any pro remnants of the proton from the nuclei, they clearly are all garbled up there. You're right.
Way you move from the fragmentation region.
Yeah, and therefore it has information about that. Yeah, I agree that, but it has information about the state at the joint, the collision.
Can you?
Result. And you multiply PP by a factor of 1. Yes. So how much actually you trust your experiments to have anything said about the difference at central and the shape, actually? Do you think that's significant within your experiments or not?
Well, depends with what precision. I mean, what are you asking me? I mean, do these agree to the fraction? I mean,
No. I'm talking about the shape in the central region. One is there's a dip, one there's the dip is less, and how significant you think that are
problem.
Within your accuracy of your experiments.
I tell you the biggest problem is these are two experiments. We actually have PP data, but we haven't analyzed it yet.
Are you saying
you compare two experiments,
I know,
systematic errors.
But the measurement, true measurement should be independent of the experiments. Are you saying that the...
But systematics are the biggest problem, then, all right? So my guess is the uncertainty there is dominated by the relative systematics between the two experiments.
Yeah, then you say that you don't believe that the difference.
The bottom is a systematic error and tests itself.
Yeah.
Do you want to comment directly?
Yeah. This N is N charge, right? I mean,
yes.
Now, you know that you have baryon stopping.
Yes.
So what makes up to compensate for the baryon stopping must be some other charged particle. Are you suggesting that there are more pions being produced at GO-GO than PP?
No. This is divided by the number of participants.
I know. Produced particles. If the baryons are stopped, presumably the shape for the baryons will be changed.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the shape of the baryons would be peaked here and goes down like that. It will be like this.
Yeah.
I mean, they will.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, very different. In fact, PP is an exponential down. And in AA, it goes up.
Yeah.
I mean,
right.
Right. I mean, PP would be like this, and AA would be like that. Yes.
So I just want to know, can you later sort of split up your final data into the different charge
Unfortunately,
components?
Unfortunately, we don't have all the information on particle identification, and that's what you said.
Well, directly to this?
Yeah, I just wanted to comment. However, the features you showed about the universal feature of the fragmentation.
I couldn't agree more with you, but in that region it'll have to be star that'll do us for us.
Okay.
Or Brown season.
Yeah. Could you pull back your summary?
The summary slide.
You comment. Yeah, next to the last summary, you said the ratio, there's no surprise. I just have comments here. I think you use only same mass particle ratios. Perhaps if you do more other ratio, we may see some, or hopefully.
I meant the ones we've measured.
Okay, right. So this is a comment. Now, I have a question about your bullet one. You said the initial energy density. To me, yeah, you use mean ET or mean energy equal to 1 GeV. That is a finally measured freeze-out. This energy could reach through the lifetime of the fireball, which could be 20 Fermi over C. So I'm just trying to understand your logic. How do you arrive at this number?
I both agree and disagree with you at the same time. The words I used was at some instant of time. I didn't say it was thermalized. I didn't say what was going on. At some instant of time, the total energy must have come from that energy that came into that cone of 45 degrees must have come from a region whose size I can estimate to be no bigger than about a Fermi longitudinally and pi r squared in the other way. And that energy must have gone into that cone. And there's no way out. It could have, you know, I was trying to get away from the other extreme just before the collision. The energy density is by far higher. That's the absolute maximum. But that's not interesting. You know, just before they collided, you have all the energy of both the Rick beams in a volume which is even smaller. All right? But that's not interesting. So you have to separate the uninteresting energy just going with the two systems, two separated systems, to energy going into a single system, which I say is into a cone at 45 degrees. So I think I'm covered.
I have a question to the energy scan. If the rapidity density and the ratios are so smoothly changing with root S and they're so boring, I'm mystified. What do you propose to look for in an energy scan, and how do you know where to look?
I tell you, I would hate in 10 years' time for us, like CERN, go back and say, let's now look, maybe the exciting things is at 40 GeV. I would like to know that earlier. And for example, I would like to know if between here and here, all right, with high precision, we are really sitting on this line and not somewhere higher or lower, for example. Okay, as an example, we never know unless we do it.
So okay. 8 points aren't enough.
No, 8 I would not think is enough. When there's a gap, that's such a bigger gap, yeah?
Paul? Yeah, could you put up again the slide of the V2 elliptic parameter versus pseudo-rapidity? I think you sort of undersold this, but I assume we're going to hear more about it later in the week. It seems to follow, more or less, the multiplicity shape Does this track at different centrality bins?
Oops, sorry.
I mean, modulo this kinematic artifact in the middle.
Sorry.
So the shape of that looks very much like the shape of the multiplicity distribution versus eta. And the question is that true at all centralities? Do they sort of continue to have the same shape at all centralities, modulo this kinematic thing in the middle?
Yeah, I don't have more information at the moment, unfortunately.
So once we're talking about energy scans, one of the theoretical motivations for doing an energy scan is that scanning an energy varies mu, as was seen from many of the plots that you showed. And with that in mind, two comments about the energy scan. First of all, looking at it from the theoretical point of view, scanning in mu, you're scanning along in the phase diagram left to right. The interesting observables to look at are probably not things as global as total multiplicity. They'll be, you know, my favorite is various particular event-by-event fluctuations. Others may have other favorites. But I wouldn't think that the way you motivate an energy scan is total multiplicity. I mean, given what we know from this plot, I would think that the way you motivate it is by other more nuanced observables. And that's my second comment. The second comment I'm speaking as a theorist. If the interesting thing to do is to vary mu, then actually the interesting energies are the lower energies. I mean, because you know the mu changes enormously more in going from AGS to SPS than it does in going from SPS to RIC. So there may be other reasons for varying the energy, but if your theoretical prejudice is the reason I'm varying the energy is to scan in mu, then actually we wait with great interest for the CERN energy scan results. Of course, it'll be interesting to get several points from RIC to go from CERN SPS, you know, from root SF17 to root SF200. But in mu, that takes you from 250 down to 40, which is no more nor less than going from AGS to RIC, AGS to SPS, which is from 500 or 600 down to 250. When did I say several? Where's Misha? Are you going to talk about this? Where's Misha? Misha, can I defer that to your talk, or do you want me to answer? Well, I'll defer to Misha, but I guess, I mean, there are many reasons for doing this, but if you're interested in searching for the critical point, then you want to scan in mu with steps in mu that are of order, you know, many tens of MeVs, we'll say 50 MeV steps in mu, 50 to 100 MeV steps in mu. So two or three steps between AGS and SPS was the thing that we said in a paper some time ago, if I'm remembering what Misha and I said before.
But just as a comment, as you already indicated, this is indeed just a SPS problem, as I said. But by the end of this year, data will exist between 10, 20, 40...
Right. But as one of the three people who picked the title of the meeting, it's QCD in the RIC era. It doesn't only mean from RIC.
What you want to use your running time for at the beginning is to investigate the things that are different. And so I think that you would want to run at the high energy where you can investigate what's happening with the hard processes rather than scan in the parameters that don't change very oddly.
Maybe let me make a comment on the
the other scan you propose, namely the particle, the mass scan. In fact, that has been also done at the SPS, and the result is that this is not trivial. You cannot just count the same number of participants and get the same results in light systems and in heavy systems. It has to do with the fact that the nuclear density distributions are complex, and you get more corona in the heavier systems than in the light systems. And so sulfur plus sulfur central does not behave exactly like lead for 60 participants. And so you cannot expect that you get a very clean cut number.
But then what you are saying is that n participants is not the best we can do, but it's not such a gold-plated variable as we would like.
I don't know whether I have seen any physical effect which depends on a 5% accuracy in the participant scale, and maybe one is barking up the wrong tree and trying to make this a highly precision measurement. Is there any other comments or questions? We have 4 minutes extra coffee time, so we'll stop at this point.